There we go. Good evening, everyone. I want to welcome you to part two of our 20th Century Moments That Mattered course, talking tonight about the Balfour Declaration. Obviously, this past month, November 2nd, November 9th, we commemorated the 100-year anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. I know there have been a lot of lectures about it, a lot of classes about it. Hopefully, we'll summarize a lot of the discussion about it, and you will leave tonight with a greater awareness of the Balfour Declaration, and more importantly, in my mind, is that you will leave tonight with a greater understanding of the totality of 20th century modern Zionism. Because in many respects, the Balfour Declaration was the culmination of many things, and in many respects, it put many things into motion. I want to thank Debbie and Simcha Firestone for sponsoring this course. We're very appreciative, as they have the entire series. And again, I encourage everyone to come throughout for some very spectacular classes. As I see on the screen, I titled it the Balfour Declaration, but now 67 words changed history. The irony is that the Balfour Declaration was very short. It was very ambiguous. It left more to the imagination than it clarified. And that's part of the legacy of the Balfour Declaration, is not so much as what it said, but also what it did not say. And that has been much of the difficulty of the Balfour Declaration over the last number of years. I am going to venture to say the air conditioner is not working right now. Okay? It was clean. The ducts were clean for the first time in 8 years today, which likely means that they broke it for the first time in 8 years. So we'll give it another couple minutes. If not, I'm going to have to pause our recording, text Matthew. It'll be a whole process.
He just passed by.
Okay, well, we're going to have to find Matthew and get him. Okay, here's what I hope to communicate tonight is a historical context for the Balfour Declaration, what life was like in Palestine before the Balfour Declaration, why did the British support it? Again, never explicitly stated. Oftentimes, we're left to conjecture. The evolution of the Balfour Declaration didn't come out of nowhere. It was obviously a process. The rabbinic responses to the Balfour Declaration, how some of the great rabbis of the time, most notably, will discuss one of the particular letters that Rav Kook, who was stuck in London at the time, a letter that he wrote to Lord Rothschild. We're going to discuss a lot the aftermath of the Balfour Declaration, right? Of course, it didn't end there in 1917, but it really continued up until the founding of the State of Israel. And lastly, I want to touch a little bit upon both the British legacy in Palestine, the complicated British legacy in Palestine, and more importantly, I want to leave you with a question that I'll ask at the end that hopefully you'll take home and will really give you some food for thought. When you talk about the Balfour Declaration, just to give it a little perspective, for us it is obviously one of the most seminal moments in 20th century modern Zionism, but for many, it is Britain's great sin. It is Britain's original sin. This is an article from 3 years ago written by a contributor to Al Jazeera, which of course already tells you a little bit about his bent. But I think it's important because it gives us sometimes when we learn Zionism, so we learn it with incredible tunnel vision. We learn it through the way that we were taught, right? I was taught a certain way in high school and in college and in the books that I choose to read, and in the Facebook posts I choose to follow. And so we have a very narrow definition of what these things mean and what the legacy of them are. So it's always important to start off with the other side. So here you have the article where he says, the effect of the declaration, third paragraph, was best summed up by the late British author, and journalist Arthur Koestler, one nation solemnly promised to a second nation the country of a third. It had no moral or legal right to do so. The Balfour Declaration contradicted Britain's previous promise of complete and final liberation for the Arabs if they rose up against their Ottoman rulers. Their subsequent revolt was pivotal for the weakening of the Ottoman Empire, and therefore the outcome of World War I, all of which we'll get to in a little bit. Obviously, if you're coming to it from an Arab perspective, the Balfour Declaration is one of the great calamities of the 20th century, because, as we'll see in a little bit, Palestine at the time was not predominantly Jewish. It was predominantly Arab. And therein lies a significant part of the problem. So let's jump right in. I'm going to start also with a quote from Arthur Balfour. This was in a speech delivered to the House of Commons, the House of Lords, in the aftermath when he was defending the Balfour Declaration. And it's a great quote because it really sums up everything we're struggling with in this class, which is where he says, "Our policy may fail, I do not deny that this is an adventure. Are we never to have adventures? Are we never to try new experiments?" So we Jews were the experiment, right? The Middle East was the great experiment of Arthur Balfour. And as I take you on this journey from really the inception of the Balfour Declaration all the way to contemporary Zionism, so I want you to keep this quote in mind, right? Are we never to try new experiments? Sometimes experiments are a little bit premature, right? Just a few moments ago, my 4-year-old daughter experimented in our house. She wanted to know what would happen if a 4-year-old lifted up a 6-year-old and started walking around, right? Some experiments aren't good experiments. Other experiments are great experiments. So for the British, this, you know, it was a fun experiment. For us, this was meant a lot more to us. And obviously there was a lot more at stake for the Jews than there were for the British. Let's just go through a little bit of a timeline of modern Jewish history. Obviously you have the Dreyfus trial in 1894. Again, according to many historians, not all historians, but according to many historians, the moment where Herzl realized that there had to be a solution to the Jewish problem. By the way, I have copies of my slideshow for anyone who wants afterwards. I like not to give them out in advance. But if you'd like afterwards, of course, you can take home. Okay, Dreyfus trial, 1894, 1896. Herzl writes his Der Judenstaat, Jewish State, where he outlines a vision for a national homeland for the Jewish people. A year later, the first Zionist Congress is held in Basel. Fifth Zionist Congress, 1901. I just threw that in because we have our JNF Shabbaton coming up. Plug for JNF in January 6th year. That's in 1901. Obviously, 1903, the very famous Sixth Zionist Congress, where Herzl proposes the Uganda Plan, which is passed, but passed by a very slim margin. And this really highlighted a great rift in the Zionist movement. Because on the one hand, you had what I'll call the traditionalists, those Zionists that were supportive of more of a traditionalist mentality and who felt that it was Palestine or bust. And then you had the bourgeois Zionists, Herzl, those who lived in Western Europe, who just felt you needed a solution to the Jewish problem. And it could be in Uganda, it could be in Turkey, it could be in Swahili. It didn't matter to them, right? All that mattered was that there was a solution to the Jewish problem, to Jewish suffering all around the world. And this was really the rift between Weizmann on the one hand — we're obviously going to spend a lot of time on Weizmann, we had a class about him last year — and Herzl on the other hand. Herzl was a believer, you needed a solution. Didn't matter what it looked like. Weizmann came from the Pale of the Settlement. He represented the masses. And for the masses, those Jews that were more traditional by nature felt, you can't give up on Palestine. You can't place the Jews in New Mexico. You can't place them in Uganda. We have a homeland. And the homeland is called Palestine. And therefore, it passed, but it passed by a very small majority. In my mind, there are two seminal events which really serve as the backdrop against the Balfour Declaration. One is almost universally accepted, and the other is my own conjecture, but I believe it to be true. And that is the Kishinev Massacre in 1903. We talked about the Kishinev Massacre 3-4 years ago in our Jews of Russia class, but I'll just explain to you why I think that was such a critical moment and really set the stage for a lot of modern religious Zionism. And the reason is as follows. The 19th century saw a tremendous amount of persecution against the Jews. Okay, most notably, there were pogroms in the 1880s. Right, Jews lived in extreme poverty throughout certainly Russia and what we'll call Eastern European countries. Okay, and when the turn of the 20th century, Jews felt that all of the problems, persecution and pogroms and poverty, were all 19th century problems. The 20th century, the dawn of the 20th century, was supposed to be a new life for Jews around the world. It was supposed to be a new beginning. And so therefore, in 1903, when you have the Kishinev Massacre, where whatever the number was, 40, 50, 60, again, disputed, but many, many Jews are massacred in Russia. So the Jews realize that the problems of the last 2,000 years weren't going to stop just because the calendar changed from 1899 to 1900 or 1901 or 1903. Secondly, the reason why the Kishinev pogroms were such a seminal moment was because it was really the first time that Jewish persecution was publicized to the world. It was the first time that this appeared in the Western media and in the Western newspapers. And so therefore, for Jews all around the world, in Western Europe, in Western parts of the world, this was their first exposure to what Jews were facing on a daily basis in Russia and in Eastern Europe. And so I believe that in many ways, the Kishinev pogrom, the Kishinev massacres in 1903, right before Pesach, was a wake-up call, not necessarily to Eastern European Jewry, reminding them that the problems of the previous century don't just change, right? Shinoi calendar, Shinoi mazel doesn't work, right? Just because you turn the calendar doesn't mean you're going to change the mazel. But it was even a bigger wake-up call to the Jews of Western Europe, and even so far as the United States, to realize that there were Jews around the world that were still facing persecution, which they thought they left in antiquity. That even with all of the changes and all of the emancipation of Jews around the world, there were still Jews being massacred for no other reason other than the fact that they were Jews and that there's anti-Semitism in the world. And I think as much as the second factor, which is I think the more popular factor, I would suggest that the Kishinev pogroms were a tremendous wake-up call to Jews, to Zionists, realizing that they needed to find a solution, and they needed to find a solution fast. And if they didn't, Jews would continue to be massacred, Jews would continue to be persecuted, Jews would continue to be killed all around the world. Okay? That was 1903. The second seminal moment, which again serves as the historical backdrop for the Balfour Declaration, and this is the more famous of the options, is World War I. Okay, World War I breaks out. We're going to skip the last two for a second. World War I breaks out, and just to give you a little bit of a sense, they changed. I used to have one that had a pointer, but I guess budget cuts. They got rid of my pointer, right? So, and there's no app. That if someone wants to make $1 million, make an app on your iPhone that it can use as a laser pointer for a PowerPoint presentation. Anyways, on your left-hand side, I'm going to switch sides so that the other people can, I'll discriminate equally. So on my right-hand side, your left-hand side, you have a map of the Middle East in 1914, the outbreak of World War I. And you see here, all of this gray represents the Ottoman Empire. Okay, so that's all of what we'll call, right, running all the way up here, all the way up to Jerusalem, Israel, Syria, all the way up is all part of the Ottoman Empire. It's a huge swath of land. Iraq, right? All of this is part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans had ruled Palestine since what year? 1507, I believe. 1507 or 1517, okay? So for a long time. And for many of those years, and this comes back to this slide, for many of those years, Palestine was largely forgotten. It was a complete afterthought to the Ottomans. Okay, I just share with you some facts. Dr. Abramowitz shared me a book about the Balfour Declaration, so I couldn't read the whole thing in the build-up to this class, but I read a lot of it, and a lot of these facts come from this book. And the entire first chapter of the book about the Balfour Declaration is just showing really the decrepit state of what Palestine was looked pre-World War I. And the reason why I share this with you is because we think of Israel and we think of Palestine, front page of the New York Times every other day, Wall Street Journal. Back then it was largely forgotten. There were 700,000 inhabitants, very poor communities. Yerushalayim, Jerusalem was one of the largest towns. And again, you see the breakdown, again, according to this book, of Jews to Muslims and Christians. Here's a great quote from T.E. Lawrence, a British philosopher, writer, author, politician, political scientist. So he writes about Jerusalem, about Israel, about Jerusalem. It's a dirty town. The streets are ill-paved and crooked, many of them being blind alleys and are excessively dirty after rain. common occurrences of typhoid, smallpox, diphtheria, and other epidemics. Right? No wonder why the Ottomans largely ignored Palestine. There wasn't much there. Right? Think about it. What existed in Israel prior to the founding of the State of Israel? It was desert. It was desert where there was no hope for anything of significance to be developed. And so the Ottomans had it, but it really didn't have too much significance to them. And again, you see on the right-hand side, just to show you how much can change in 100 years of world history. So you have Egypt, you have Lebanon, you have Turkey, Syria, right? Iraq, Kuwait, Yemen, all of these, Israel, obviously, all of which kind of broke apart in the aftermath of World War I, okay? World War I finds the Ottoman Empire on the same side as the Germans against the United States, who came in later to the world, but British and France, okay? And the Zionists made a tremendous gamble, right? One of the great gambles, really, of Jewish history. Maybe we'll another class, right? Great gambles of Jewish history. But the Zionists made a gamble, and that was that during World War I, they picked sides, not knowing what the outcome was going to be, right? If the Ottoman Empire, Russians even, right? If they had won World War I, and the Zionists had aligned themselves with the British and the France, Jewish history would look a lot different. Zionists picked a side. And by the way, that was not universally accepted. There were many in the Zionist camp who felt that you should remain neutral. Hedge your bets, right? One side just as likely of a chance of winning as the other side, okay? And it was Weizmann and others who pushed to ally themselves with the British. And again, that's what really set a lot of this into motion, okay? The British, even before the conclusion of World War I, they started making promises left and right. And part of these promises is what got them into trouble and continues to get us into trouble to this very day. What do I mean by that? First, you have the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, right? You'll hear a lot about this if you read Jewish history textbooks, if you read anti-Zionist propaganda. One of the things you'll hear about is, very nice that you Jews were promised Palestine. We'll see what you were actually promised, but in theory you were promised Palestine through the Balfour Declaration. But even before that, the British had made a deal with Sharif Hussein of Mecca, okay, that if he would help the British fight against the Ottoman Turks, then they would promise them an independent Arab state. Again, a lot of this has to be viewed against the backdrop of World War I, right? The British were trying to win the war. And to win the war, you wanted to create an organic uprising against the Ottoman Empire. So there are two ways to do it. One is to bring an army in from the outside. The other is to take those who live there already and to kind of create chaos. And so that's what the British tried to do. They basically cut a deal with the Arabs and said, if you make life miserable enough for the Ottomans and you help us in our efforts, we'll give you an independent Arab state in the aftermath of it. Now the problem with that is that right afterwards, they made, I don't remember the first name, but Sykes from Britain and Picot from France made the Sykes-Picot Agreement, where, and again, you'll see this just over a year before the Balfour Declaration, where they basically decided how they were going to divide up the Ottoman Empire at the conclusion of World War I. Now, that's funny, because World War I wasn't yet done. So why were they making this deal? Right? So, again, depending on what book you read, you get very different versions. Most likely, they were jostling. Right? They were jostling for position. There's a large sentiment, certainly if you read Chaim Weizmann's autobiography, he develops this a lot, that the British and France there was not a lot of love lost between the two of them. And the British had their own specific reasoning for why they wanted the division to take place the way that it took place. And we'll see that in a little bit. Okay, they did not trust the French with what we'll call Palestine. Okay, they didn't trust the French. And so a lot of this is posturing so that when World War I would ultimately conclude, they would already have the framework for how they were going to divide Palestine. Okay? I'll just share with you a quote. It's a lot to read, but you'll have it in the packet. Interesting to note that even though they make this Sykes-Picot Treaty, and again, you see how the division was supposed to take place, right? Arab under British, Arab in France, in Russia, we're going to divide this part. Arab, France. Again, who comes out the big winner? The British come out, I think, the winner in a lot of this. Okay? But the funny thing is that despite the fact that they made this deal, they never mentioned it to the Zionists. So the British were talking out of one side of the mouth and talking somewhere else to another set of people, right? They were cutting deals left and right. So while they were negotiating with Weizmann and the Zionists, they were cutting deals on the side with the French that didn't take into account what they were negotiating with the Zionists. Okay, so there were a lot of players in the mix, a lot of cooks in the kitchen, a lot of different factors, and a lot of different people with a lot of different allegiances, each posturing for position so that when World War I would ultimately conclude, they would be in a position for control. The mega question is, why did the British do it? Right? Why did the British do it? So I'll give you four suggestions. One and two are similar, but they're actually a little bit different. Okay? Again, these are, I'm sure there are more. These are four that I came across in my research and in my reading. And again, there are arguments back and forth for each one. The first is from Shlomo Avineri, who's a prominent political scientist in Israel, who writes the following. But the main goal of the Balfour Declaration, as far as Britain was concerned, was to reduce the opposition of the American Jewish community to going to war on its side. Among the reasons the declaration was written as a letter to Lord Rothschild, right, again, depending on who you ask, but most likely Weizmann was the main negotiator. So why is it written? The actual Balfour Declaration is written to Lord Rothschild. So why? It was also the consideration that the Rothschild family's connections with Jewish financiers in New York would aid in this mission. Again, everyone is posturing. So if you give the Jews a little carrot, so maybe they'll use their influence in America to promote America entering the war, right? When did America enter World War I? It was later. It was much later. Okay? And so it was to Britain's benefit that America would enter into the war on the Allies' side. And so this was a little bit of a token to American Jewry to have them put pressure. Similar, it's a little bit different. But here I came across a different, right? And again, it brings Russia into the fold as well, which is that Britain's leaders hoped that a formal declaration in favor of Zionism would gain Jewish support for the Allies in neutral countries, in the United States, and especially in Russia, where the powerfully anti-Semitic Tsarist government had just been overthrown with the help of Russia's significant Jewish population. Okay? How true is that? It's also the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Right? Where did Jews fall out? Again, not necessarily so clear. One thing is very clear from point number two, which is that nations always view us as having an extreme amount of influence, whether or not we actually had that influence, right? The notion that the Jews control the banks and they control the world and they control the media, all these anti-Semitic attacks lobbied against us actually worked in our favor. Because Britain felt that if they can convince the masses in Russia, hey, they just overthrew the Tsar, maybe they'll convince Russia now to enter into the war. And again, that benefits Great Britain as well. Number three is a genuine belief in the righteousness of the Zionist cause. Right, I have a quote. I didn't put it in this PowerPoint, but it's a quote from Lloyd George, I believe, who was the prime minister at the time, who said basically, when I signed on to this declaration, so I knew that no matter what I do, if I sign on, if I don't sign on, I'm going to upset one group. He said, but to Chaim Weizmann, but I happen to think you're right. So I'd rather side with you guys. Right, so I think there was a little bit a genuine belief in the righteousness of the Zionist cause, right? The oppressed gaining a country has many benefits to it. Many, the little guy rising up and taking over. Again, there are lots of benefits to that. Number four is a land bridge between crucial territories of Egypt and India. If you think about a map with Egypt, the Mediterranean, going all the way west, so Israel, and this is partially why Israel even to this day is such a significant place, so Israel plays a crucial link. If Great Britain wanted to create a bastion or a connectivity between many of the countries that they had a hold over, so Palestine was in the middle of it, right? So if you look back at the map over here, so again, this is under British protection. That makes sense, because if you're going from Egypt westward, Eastward. So you're going to want this plot of land as well. And again, that's that suggestion. So four suggestions for why the British entered into this declaration. Okay? Let's talk a little bit about Chaim Weizmann. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on him because we had a whole people of the book about him last year. I'll just point out a few things. Number one is a reminder that Weizmann grew up in a very traditional setting. He went to Cheder as a child, as opposed to Herzl, who came from a very secular setting. And again, as we spoke about last year, that is what really distinguishes their difference of perception, how they perceived the issue and the ways to fix the issue. For Weizmann, who came from a traditional setting, he came amongst the masses, so he had to bring the masses along. There wasn't just a political solution. It had to be a Zionist solution. People had to rally around it. And it had to be about Palestine. There was a religious component to this. There was a traditional component to it. To Herzl wasn't a traditionalist. Herzl was a bourgeois person. He was interested in making political connections and felt that the solution was a political solution. And again, that, as we discussed a little bit earlier, was part of the rift between Herzl on the one hand and Weizmann on the other hand. Again, Weizmann had a tremendous amount of respect for Herzl, but he also was very nervous about Herzl's approach. He didn't feel that it was the correct approach. He felt that Herzl was kind of he was building a pyramid, but he was cutting out the ground floor, which is taking the masses along with you. Okay? The other thing I'll point out, again, and you see in 1899, he receives his doctorate in chemistry. Okay? As we'll see here, he is considered the father of industrial fermentation. Right? He has the Weizmann organism, used acetone in the Allied war effort, and that ultimately is what put him in the right place at the right time to be in a position of influence on behalf of the Zionists in London at the time. Okay? Saw this also last year, I believe, at some point, but I'll share it with you again. This is Weizmann from his autobiography. So he writes about his first meeting with Lord Balfour. Very famous quote, where he says, "Then suddenly I said, Mr. Balfour." Having a whole conversation, he just gets the feeling, sometimes you have this, where someone looks at you with a blank stare, and you're trying to sell them on a product or sell them on something, and they're just like, they're in their happy place. Right, they're out on the golf course, okay, by the pool, whatever it is. So that's what Weizmann gets the sense. He's talking with Balfour, and Balfour's mind is just, he's not getting that love. So he says, "Then suddenly I said, Mr. Balfour, suppose I were to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it?" He sat up, looked at me, and answered, "But Dr. Weizmann, we have London." "That is true," I said, "but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh." He leaned back, continued to stare at me, and said two things which I remember vividly. The first was, "Are there many Jews who think like you?" I answered, "I believe I speak the minds of millions of Jews who will never see, who you will never see, and who you cannot speak for themselves, but with whom I can pave the streets of the country I come from." This he said, "If this is so, you will one day be a force." Shortly before, the Jew Balfour said, "It is curious, the Jews I meet are quite different." I answered, "Mr. Balfour, you meet the wrong kind of Jews." Okay? Weizmann's major takeaway from this, if you continue on in his autobiography is called Trial and Error, I believe. I don't even think you can get it on Amazon, right? We've been through this before, but someone was nice enough to give me a copy, and it's really brilliantly written. It's very inspiring. But he goes on in his autobiography to describe that what his takeaway from this was, that so much about the way the British leaders, Britain's leaders, viewed this issue was based on ignorance. And if they were educated about it, so you'd be able to woo them over to your side. Okay, just last night, there was an Israel Bonds event. Ido Aharoni, the former ambassador to New York, spoke, and he made what I thought was a great observation. He said, if you want to understand the challenges in Israel nowadays, this is a parenthetical thought, you have to look to Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan, right? Kazakhstan, a country. It's pretty big. Kazakhstan, whatever, Kazakhstan. There's a West Wing episode about that. Right, what was the website? He confuses Kazakhstan and some other stan. And it's a very funny episode back and forth, okay? So anyways, Kazakhstan. See, so why? So the whole crowd, Brody was texting me at the time, why is he talking about Kazakhstan, right? What's going on here? So he said, for those of you who remember, I don't know, none of you ever saw, I didn't see it, so I'm going to be honest, okay? But there was this movie produced in, I think it was 2004, called Borat. Anyone see that movie? So apparently, I looked it up on Wikipedia today to understand what I was talking about. So apparently, the whole movie, Sacha Baron Cohen, it's about this Kazakhstanian person who comes to America, and it's all basically it's supposed to be mocking America, and supposed to be mocking the West, but it really mocks Kazakhstan because of the way he projects himself and portrays himself. So Ido Aharoni says the message of that movie is that Kazakhstan is still reeling from the depiction created in Borat. In other words, most of us are never going to go to Kazakhstan. We're never going to meet a Kazakhstanian person, right? We're never going to read an article about Kazakhstan. So what are we ever going to know about Kazakhstan? We're going to think of Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat. Now, why are we going to think about that? Because some comedian had this ludicrous idea, created a fictitious narrative, and that's the narrative we're stuck with. And because Kazakhstan did nothing to counter that narrative, that's the image that every single one of us has in our head. And we're fairly educated people. Said Ido Aharoni, that's how you understand the Israeli narrative, or the falsity of the Israeli narrative. Because so much of what people think about Israel is simply because anyone can make any narrative they want. Palestinians can make any narrative they want. Egyptians can make any narrative they want. Jordanians can make any narrative, right? I'm reading, for some ungodly reason, I'm reading King Hussein of Jordan's autobiography now, right? So the Jordanians have their fictitious version of how things, anyone can make a version. And nowadays, if you have a website or someone willing to publish your book, so anyone's going to read it. And that's going to be the narrative that people have in their minds. So the challenge for Israel nowadays, Ido Aharoni was saying, that if you don't counter that, if you don't put out information that clarifies that, if you leave a vacuum, so this false narrative will clarify the vacuum. So that's, I think it's a brilliant insight. I'm no quicker to see the movie, but at least what I read on Wikipedia, I think it's a brilliant insight into understand how fake news, real fake news works, how false narratives are created, okay? And again, that was back to where I started. That was a big tangent, but that was Weizmann's takeaway with his meeting from Balfour. Now, Balfour just didn't know any better. He wasn't exposed to a correct narrative. He wasn't exposed to the types of Jews who believed in it as passionately as he did. And he believed, therefore, if you educated them, so you can bring them over to your side. One of the challenges with the Balfour Declaration was the tension with the assimilationists. Okay? I didn't bring this, but there was you can find online an article from the New York Times written in 1919. So after the Balfour Declaration, before the San Remo Conference where it was ratified, where assimilationist Jews in America wrote a letter, open letter, to Woodrow Wilson encouraging him to vote against San Remo, against the Balfour Declaration, essentially. Okay? And they have four major points for their opposition. Number one is the declaration, in other words, creating a homeland for the Jewish people, essentially limits the claims of Jews for full citizens in other lands. Right? If I want to be an American, if I want to be a Russian at the time, so how can I argue that Russia should give me freedom and Russia should give me citizenship when, go home. Right? You have a national homeland for the Jewish people. Why are you allowed to be a Russian citizen when you have a land to yourself? Okay? Now, obviously, that's a threat for people that want to feel comfortable in their host countries. Okay, number two, Jews are dedicated heart and soul to the welfare of the countries in which they live. They should never be viewed as double allegiances. Right? This is an issue that we've seen in America, and we continue to see in America. Right? If I work in the intelligence community in America, and I'm an Orthodox Jew, right? I have a relative, we'll leave it at that, who worked in the intelligence community in America. And this was a constant concern, that she's been to Israel many times, right? She's a devout Zionist, and she's working in the intelligence community. Who are your allegiances to? Push comes to shove. Are you a Jew? Are you an American? Right? So the assimilationists were nervous. How can my heart and soul be dedicated to Britain, to Russia, to America, if I now have a state of Israel that I'm supporting, and a state of Israel that I am promoting and defending. Okay? Number three, what about those who can't emigrate? Right? Very nice if hundreds of thousands of Jews leave Russia to go to Palestine, but what about the 50,000 that stay back? What's their status going to be? What's their continued relations with the local peasantry going to be? How are local Russians going to view them? Right? Is anti-Semitism going to go down? Is anti-Semitism going to go up? Right? What happens to those who can't emigrate for financial reasons, for whatever reasons? And lastly, but not least, we'll see in a second, the words race and religion appear in various versions of the Balfour Declaration, but whichever term you use, those are against the post-World War I democratic principles. Okay? American history, right? Woodrow Wilson, post-World War I, creates the League of Nations. Popular or unpopular? What? I wasn't alive, right? Very unpopular, okay? Woodrow Wilson was viewed as... But why was that created? What was the whole premise of the League of Nations in the aftermath of World War I? The whole premise was that the world should never see another war. Right? You have to bring the countries together. That we're going to break down the barriers between countries. And even if you have Britons and Frenchmen and Russians and Americans, but those are divided geographically. They're not divided by race or religion. Britain has peoples of all races and religion. America has peoples of all race and religion. All of a sudden, you're creating a homeland specifically for one race or one religion. That goes against all of the democratic efforts in the aftermath of World War I. So for these four reasons, there were many assimilationists that were, again, sometimes, oftentimes, Jews are their own worst enemies. They were fighting vociferously against the ratification of the Balfour Declaration, against the passage, lobbying Britain against the Balfour Declaration. Okay, and again, I'm not going to read this now, but I have here a speech from Weizmann. Again, it's in his autobiography, where he basically lays down the hammer on the assimilationists. Okay? He basically says, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to get on board, or we're going to steamroll you over. Because we're going with or without you. Right? And then he says, in addition to that, he says, we do not want to offer the world a spectacle of a war of brothers. We are surrounded by too many enemies to be able to afford this luxury. But we warn those who will force an open breach that they will find us prepared to stand up united in defense of the cause which is sacred to us. We will not allow anyone to interfere with the dot, dot, dot. Right? In other words, we're prepared to offer a united front, but united is going to be on our terms. And if you don't get on board, get out of the way, because we're going ahead with our agenda either way. Now, why is that important? Why are the assimilationists important? So I want to share with you two versions of the Balfour Declaration, and then the final version of the Balfour Declaration. Now, we're going to read this together. I know it's a little small and blurry, okay? I'll read it to you, and I want you to point out or to recognize the evolution of the Balfour Declaration, right? People shouldn't just think that manna from heaven, the Balfour Declaration, fell down. Didn't work that way, okay? Here is the version that was submitted by the Zionist Weizmann to the British government. And it read as follows. His Majesty's government, after considering the aims of the Zionist organization, accept the principle of recognizing Palestine as the national home of the Jewish people and the right of the Jewish people to build up its national life in Palestine under a protection to be established at the conclusion of peace following upon the successful issue of the war. His Majesty's government regard as essential for the realization of this principle the grant of internal autonomy to the Jewish nationality of Palestine, freedom of immigration of the Jews, and the establishment of a national Jewish national colonizing corporation for the re-establishment and economic development of the country. The conditions and forms of the internal autonomy in a charter, dot, 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 okay? Dot, 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 okay? That's version number one. Like it or don't like it? Who likes it? Thumbs up, right? What do we like about this version? You have it handy. What word did you notice?
I like the
why do you like that word?
It means it's not the
Good. Yocheved Andy likes the word reestablishment, because reestablishing means that it once was there and we're simply bringing it back. What else? What else do we like about it? Control, right? Autonomy. We like the word autonomy. Okay, what other words do you like in here?
Immigration.
Immigration's a biggie. Okay? What else do we like? Well, I like national home of the Jewish people, right? Recognizing us as people. That sounds really exciting to me. Okay? Here's the version based on a lot of pushback from the assimilationists. Well, first, that gets voted down. Okay? Because here's the version that comes back. Okay? And again, I have the dates for you there just so you, right? It didn't happen overnight. But this is the version back. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment of Palestine of a national home for the Jewish race and will use its best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed in any other country by such Jews who are fully contented with their existing nationality and citizenship. Like it or don't like it? What don't you like about it?
Race.
Well, we don't like the word race, right? We like people a lot more than race, okay? This basically is a nice way of saying nothing, right? Again, look at line number two. We'll use its best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. You know what that's called? We'll try, right? Right, double talk. It's like my kids know already, okay? Daddy, can we do this? We'll see. Right? We'll see is a code word for
no.
No. Okay? So we'll try our best is a code word for I'm not getting back to you. Lose my number. Okay? The other thing, there are many additions to this version that were absent of the first versions. Like what? First of all, does the first version make any mention whatsoever of non-Jewish communities in Palestine? No. Does it mention anything about the political status of Jews who choose not to emigrate? No. Again, so you see already, that's why I shared with you the objections of the assimilationists, because you see it in real time in this version here. You see the pushback from the Arabs. You see the pushback from the Jews. Right? This was not, again, what I'm trying to communicate is that this was not a fait accompli. This was not handed on a silver platter. There was a lot of back and forth. Okay? The Jews get this version. And what the British do, although we don't like that version either, okay? So what do? There's a back and forth. And what Britain does is they put 8 people in a room together, okay? I have to apologize for these faces. My kids like to go through the PowerPoint before me, so we're having a little fun. On your left-hand side, I believe he's an actor from Law & Order.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And on the right-hand side, I have no idea, but we were having fun, so you'll forgive us, okay? But what they did is they took 8 people. Again, Weizmann details the entire thing in his autobiography. They took 8 people, 4 Zionists, 4 anti, what I'm calling anti-Zionists. In other words, people on both sides of the spectrum, and they stuck them in a room together. And they said, basically, come back to us with a proposal. Weizmann details that there were 2 particular things that he argued should be put back in. He says, instead of the establishment of a Jewish home, would it not be more desirable to use the word reestablishment? That was Yocheved Handy's point, right? Weizmann said, reestablish means we were here once. This is not new. Okay, number 2 is he wanted them to use the word Jewish people and not Jewish race. Again, for reasons that we can all figure out. Okay, what's the final version? So the final version is, Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. Here it is. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in other countries. Sounds very similar to? Oops. Sounds very similar to this version. Right? You got one thing changed. You got it changed from race to people. Otherwise, pretty much verbatim. Okay? Weitzman responds. Weitzman responds. While the cabin was in session approving the final text, I was waiting outside. This time within call. Sykes brought the document out to me with the explanation, "Dr. Weitzman, it's a boy!" Well, I did not like the boy at first. He was not the one I had expected. But I knew that this was a great departure. I telephoned my wife and went to see Achad Am, again, of course, one of the great Zionists. Okay, and that is, again, I'm trying to communicate the various versions, the evolution of the Balfour Declaration, to help us appreciate that this did not happen in a vacuum, and that there were many different sides, back and forth. There were those who were in favor of stronger language, those who walked it back, and unfortunately, the statement that we have now. Now, why do I say unfortunately? A, because it's not what Weizmann had hoped for, and it's not what they had spent years and years and years lobbying for. Number two is, if you look at the actual statement, and I know it's a little bit hard to read, but hopefully we're familiar with it, it leaves a lot to be desired. It leaves a lot unclear. Let's read it again. His Majesty the Governor will view with favor, okay, it's very different than will establish, right? Will view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. Very ambiguous. What does that actually mean? Okay? It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Now, what does that mean? But what does that mean, that we'll do nothing to prejudice the civil and religious life of the non-Jewish communities, Arabs? What does that mean? Translate that for me. Well, that doesn't translate as there'll be an uprising. What does that mean? Practically, you're reading this. You're living in Palestine at the time. You're getting a country, and you can't prejudice the civil and religious rights of the non... What does that mean? No, don't tell me. What does it mean? You're now, I put you in charge. You are all now in charge of governing the new state of Palestine. How do you form a national home for the Jewish people?
You can't.
Okay? A people, by the way, that is a religious people, and also at the same time, not prejudice the civil or religious rights of those existing there. What is that, right? So part of the challenge is that the statement is, my guess is purposefully ambiguous, right? Because that's how it gets ratified, but it's very ambiguous. And a lot of the challenges in any article you read, go online now, there are thousands of articles written about the Balfour Declaration on the 100-year anniversary, right? A lot of them will highlight the fact that many of the challenges, that at least the arguments on both sides, at least the way they project it, is based on the ambiguity of the Balfour Declaration. Right, the Arabs look at this and say, how you're going to make an argument that over the last 100 years, the Jews haven't prejudiced the civil or religious rights of non-Jewish communities? You know, I'll just make the arguments, throwing us out of the land, right, not giving us right, whatever it is, okay? It's very ambiguous, okay? So the Jews focus on the Jewish homeland part. The Arabs focused on the prejudice, civil, religious, okay, you get the point. It's very ambiguous. What are the responses from Palestine? So here's a celebration in Haifa. Beis November Yontif Shelanu, Yontif Lanu, that it's a Yontif for us. Okay? And now I have to go here because I can't see there. But I'm going to read it for you. Hu Hayom Histori. It's a historical day. Yom Matan Hahatz. I can't read it here. Me'et Minister Linyane Achutz Beinglia Balfour, right, when they gave us the declaration from the Minister Balfour, Bait Leumi La'am Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael, right, a national homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And then he quotes, again, it's easier, you know, let me pull it in here, it'll be easier for me even. Okay, it's not because my eyesight's going, it's because technology stinks, okay? I want to read to you because it's really beautiful language, I think. Here we go. It is equally unclear. Okay. But anyways, it calls for an asifat am. On the left-hand side, it's a little clearer, but it's a moda'a, it's a declaration. But Yom HaShabbat, Chaf Zayin Cheshvan, to November, Shebo Huva, right? That was established, Feast Parmesa, and it was publicized. Hahatz something, Shalom Shelet, Britnia, Hagdola, Tovat Am Yisrael. The declaration on behalf of the Jewish people, Lizkor Hayom Haistaria Zeh, in order to commemorate this historical day, Hinenu Mevakshim Et Kol Gaba'e, Umin Halei Batei Kneos Shebeyafo, Uvimosh Hosea, we're declaring that all the Gabayim in the Shul, that every leader, Lekashet Et Batei HaKnesiot, right, I'm over here, Lekashet Et Batei HaKnesiot, Ve'arona Rakodesh, right, that you should adorn, beautify the Aron Kodesh, the Shul should be beautiful, Ulevarech Et Hayad Malchuto, George HaFamishi Lishpachto, and you should make a special blessing in Shul on behalf of King George, Vata Minister Achitzon, Arthur Balfour, and on behalf of Balfour Shaliado, and his Galgala Zuchuzos, through which this tremendous merit happened, Ulatir Ba'al Itzvonam, and that, right, that we should, Hashem should shower Great Britain with many blessings. Okay? So again, you get a sense that this was obviously a momentous occasion. This was an ecstatic moment for Jews, the notion that in Shul that Shabbos, they were making Mishaberachs for King George and for Balfour, that they were adorning the shuls, they were beautifying the shuls, they were making Asifa Da'ams, they were gathering together for celebration. Here's a letter from Rav Kook to Lord Rothschild, right? And again, it's on the 23rd of Mar Cheshvan, I believe. So it's like 2 weeks after the Balfour Declaration. But he says here, Adoni Na'aleh, right, my great friend. Let me go to this side so I can point it, right? No, it's not. Mirov Rikshei Simchati, out of incredible feelings of happiness. Al Haskamata Ha'ezina Shel Mamshela Britnia, the agreement of Britain. Yarom Hoda ala Hagashmat Tikunto Ha'lumit, right, the national establishment, Lashiv Lanu at Eretz Avotenu, to return us to the land of our forefathers, Asher Zachita Ata Adon Yakar, which you, the great one, the precious one, Liyot Hatsir HaMevaser Et Abisra Tova Azo, you are the conduit to bring this great tidings, Asher Kabalta Me Eit Hadarat HaMinistar HaPnimi, Mar Balfour, right? That Balfour sent it to you. Hinanim Livarech et Kvodo, I want to bless his honor. May Omek Livavi, from the depths of my heart, Bivracha Ne'amana, Shetit Chazka Yadav Be'avodat HaKodesh Shel Binyan Amenu Al Eretz Chemdatenu, I want to give him a blessing that he should continue to Bizoche, to build our land. Ve'azchus HaGadol Hu Shel Besur Reshit HaTzad Shel Smichat Keren Yeshuat Yisrael. This is the first part of the redemption of the Jewish people, dot, in this flowery language. You think Rav Kook was happy? You betcha, right? Rav Kook, of course, was in London at the time. Rav Kook was caught in London in the beginning of World War I. And most people assume that Rav Kook was intimately involved because he was in London. Actually, that's not the case. He was largely shunned by the Zionist movement. He was really on the outskirts. But nonetheless, again, he was very excited. If you read the autobiography of Rav Kook by, what's his name? No, who wrote the book? No, sorry, the biography of Rav Kook, sorry, by, no, it's like that, Mirsky, right? Whatever his name, Mirsky. So he writes in there, he translates a bunch of letters from Rav Kook around this time where Rav Kook talks about how he has this new renewed energy to work on behalf of Zionism, to renew work on behalf of the redemption, because, you know, he viewed this as a significant victory. Okay? Unfortunately, it was short-lived. You have the Palestine-Arab revolt in 1936 to 1939. That would be a very interesting revolt. What were they fighting for? An end to Jewish immigration in Palestine, an end to the transfer of land to Jewish landowners, and a new general representative government. Of course, the Arabs were horrified by the Balfour Declaration. And so you have the Peel Commission, which was established by Great Britain, led by Lord Robert Peel, sent to Palestine to basically survey and to try to find a solution to the Arab-Jewish conflict. Okay? In the aftermath, so he suggests the following. He suggests a partition, where he says everything in pink is going to be Arab state, everything in orange is going to be a Jewish state, and the green is mandated under British control. Okay? Partition. Would you take deal or no deal? Well, we say no deal, but you put yourself in the shoes in 1936. Deal or no deal? Hitler's coming to power, ominous clouds emerging from Germany. So the Zionists were largely split on this, right? Many felt take it, many felt don't take it, wait for a better deal, right? This is Trump politics right here, okay? Didn't matter, because the Arabs rejected it, right? Because again, they weren't interested in just part, they wanted the whole thing to be pink, okay? Ultimately, you come to the white paper, the tragic white paper issued in May 17, 1939, rejected the Peel Commission's partition plan on the grounds that it wasn't feasible. And the white paper basically tore the Balfour Declaration to shreds. It limited Jewish immigration to 75,000 over the next five years. Again, obviously set into motion a limit on immigration, which proves horrific, you know, horrible during the Holocaust, the aftermath of the Holocaust, ended Jewish land purchases, called for independence for Palestine within 10 years, and made equivocally clear that it is not the British policy, unequivocally clear, it is not the British policy that Palestine become a Jewish state. Literally, tore the Balfour Declaration up to shreds. I've quoted in the past that Rav Kook's son, Tzvi Yehuda Kook, writes that his father read the newspaper every day, but he never saw his father get agitated about reading the newspaper except for once in his life. And that was when he read about the white papers. He was so upset about it because, again, it really undid everything that was communicated through the Balfour Declaration. Here you have, I just shared with you the white paper, or a quote from it. His Majesty's government believed that the framers of the mandate in which the Balfour Declaration was embodied could not have intended that Palestine should be converted into a Jewish state against the will of the Arab population of the country. By the way, it's not out of blue, right? You could read that into the Balfour Declaration, where you talk about not going to prejudice against the religious and political, right? You could read that into that. His Majesty's government therefore now declare unequivocally that it is not part of their policy that Palestine should become a Jewish state. They would indeed regard it as contrary to the obligations, right, their obligations to the Arabs. Again, part of the Balfour Declaration. Under the mandate, as well as to the insurance which had been given to the Arab people in the past, right? That's the McCann-Hussein agreement, that the Arab population of Palestine should be made the subjects of Jewish state against their will. Okay? Again, literally undid everything that the Balfour Declaration had communicated. Okay? Historical fact or modern recognition? The last few slides, again, we've learned about the build-up to the Balfour Declaration. We've learned about the Balfour Declaration. We've learned about how the ratification of the Balfour Declaration wasn't so simple. We've learned about the aftermath of the Balfour Declaration and really the destruction that is left in its midst, the confusion that's left in its midst. Okay? But one thing I want to clarify, and this is a quote I have here. I'll bring you two quotes from David Ben-Gurion's testimony before the Peel Commission. Okay? Two quotes. As a reminder that for us, the Balfour Declaration was simply a recognition of something that we already knew. It was not creating a historical reality. Okay? So let me read to you this quote. Now again, this is not David Ben-Gurion didn't speak in English. Right? This is a translation. But I believe this was from his biography, so hopefully it's clear. 300 years ago, there came to the New World a boat, and its name was the Mayflower. Mayflower's landing on Plymouth Rock was one of the great historical events in the history of England and in the history of America. But I would like to ask any Englishman sitting here on this commission, what date did the Mayflower leave port? What date was it? I'd like to ask the Americans, do they know which date the Mayflower left the port in England? How many people were on board the boat? Who were their leaders? What kind of food did they eat on the boat? More than 3,300 years ago, long before the Mayflower, our people left Egypt. Every Jew in the world, wherever he is, knows what day they left, and he knows what food they ate, and we still eat that food every anniversary, and we know who our leader was, and we sit down and we tell the story to our children and grandchildren in order to guarantee that it will never be forgotten. And we say our two slogans: now we may be enslaved, but next year we'll be a free people. Bring it to your Seder table. Seriously, bring it to your Seder table. Right? Have this discussion at your Seder table this year with your family, with your children, with your grandchildren, helping them have a little bit of historical perspective of how unique our history is and how unique our telling over of our history is and how blessed we really are to have that narrative, that historical narrative, to be able to feed off of. Second quote, I think even more pointed, again, from the same speech. This is the more famous one. I say on behalf of the Jews that the Bible is our mandate. In other words, you, Britain, don't think that you're giving us the right to live in our land. The Bible is our mandate. The Bible, which was written by us in our own language, well, not really, in our own language, in Hebrew, in this very country. That is our mandate. It is only recognition of this right which was expressed in the Balfour Declaration. So, again, I think when we talk about the legacy of the Balfour Declaration, it's important to remember that while obviously we're talking about moments that mattered in the 20th century, obviously the Balfour Declaration was the seminal moment of Zionism, right? And again, we could have chosen the founding of the State of Israel, right? We could have chosen other moments that mattered of Zionism, but I purposely chose the Balfour Declaration because, again, I think it culminates so much and sets into motion so much, but it's important to remember that it's simply the recognition of our historical right to our homeland. It is not the British gift to us. Okay? And I think that's just important to keep in mind. Okay? You can cheer for that. Lastly, two more things.
12 hours.
The British legacy. So obviously, while we view the Balfour Declaration largely in a positive light, so there is a very mixed relationship that the Zionists have toward the British. And you have here from the Menachem Begin book, Danny Gordis. Of course, Begin was not a fan of the British, right? You don't need to have a PhD in political science to know that Begin wasn't a fan of the British. Okay? Now, why wasn't? Because, as he writes here, Begin never shared the prevailing gratitude to the British Empire for the Balfour Declaration. In 1943, awaiting news of his parents, who, like millions of European Jews, had been barred by the British from finding sanctuary in Palestine. Don't forget, the white papers limited immigration, which meant that Jews could no longer escape into our homeland. He was more convinced than ever that if the Jews were intent on creating their own sovereign state in their ancestral homeland, there would be no choice but to treat the British as the enemies that they were. And of course, that was a marked departure from the past 40-some-odd years of Zionist history, where everything was predicated upon almost earning it from countries and from your allies. Begin came to the realization that we're going to do it on our own. Given what was unfolding in Europe, the Jews more than ever before needed a country of their own, and the British, who were preventing homeless Jews from entering Palestine and were thus complicit in the ongoing deaths of thousands of Jews, would depart Palestine only if staying became too costly and painful. So again, you have that mixed emotion. On the one hand, you have a sense of gratitude. On the other hand, you look at what the British did during the Holocaust, limiting immigration, forcing Jews to return back to literally the gas chambers, and you certainly have a mixed reviews on the British legacy. And again, just to give you the whole picture, again, we're trying to take you through the entire process. The last slide. I shared with this in a class at BRS a little while ago, but at the APAC Rabbinical Conference, they do a national rabbinical conference every year before the Yom Nerayim, before the high holidays. And I happen to have gone to a session by Ken Stein. Ken Stein, of course, a professor at Emory University, a great Zionist historian in America. And he started off the class, he gave us each a pad and a pen. And again, you're in a room full of rabbis. And he asked us the following question. He said, what is the legacy of 20th century Zionism? And if you had to characterize, what is the legacy of 20th century Zionism. And everyone wrote down, there were a few other questions he asked, but this was number one. And everyone, right, and then he asked if it failed. Right, did 20th century Zionism fail in your mind? Okay, which is an interesting question, right? Good Shabbos table fodder for this week when people ask what Moskowitz spoke about. Start a conversation, right? What's the legacy of 20th century Zionism? And did it succeed or fail by your definition of it? Okay, so we all offered our answers. And then he offered an answer which I think is brilliant. It's short, it's concise, but in many respects captures, I think, a lot of the emotions that we feel when we talk, or we should feel when we talk about this issue. And his answer was, the legacy of 20th century Zionism is the ability to choose our own destiny. What do I mean by that? What did he mean by that? He meant that for 2,000 years, could Jews do what they wanted? Never. Right? We were always reliant on a host country. And even if the host country was good to us, we were still reliant on that host country. And when that host country decided that the political winds were turning against the Jews, they dropped us like a bad habit. Right? We lived in Spain for many years under great conditions until we became persona non grata in Spain and we were kicked out. Right? You go through the country. Right? There's a great article where a woman writes how she bought a German car and our grandmother was horrified that she bought a German car because of what they did to the Jews. And she says, so she started researching. What country could she buy a car from? Right? Right? What country are you going to buy a car from? You're going to buy a Japanese car? Not buying a Japanese car. Right? What friend? Every country has persecuted us. We've been kicked out of everywhere. Right? So he argued, and I think it's so brilliant, that the greatest legacy, the greatest, what Zionism introduced, 20th century Zion introduced, was the confidence and the ability to make choices for ourselves. Good, bad, and ugly in Israel nowadays. Right? And Israel has many challenges. Okay? It has challenges internally. It has challenges externally. Right? But no matter what the challenges are, there's one thing and there's one thing that we know for sure. And that is that we can decide the solutions for ourselves. Right? We have an army that can protect us. We have leaders that are democratically elected, that can make decisions and are accountable to the people. Right? We can choose, and we were never able to choose for 2,000 years. And I'll leave you with this question. Okay? Freedom of choice is something that is new to the Jewish people. 2,000 years we were Jewish for one reason and one reason only. And that is because my anti-Semite neighbor told me I was Jewish. And every time I walked out of the house and he spit at me, he reminded me I was a Jew. And for the first time in 2,000 years, we get to choose what it means to be a Jew. And we get to choose to be Jewish, and we get to choose to be Zionist. Exactly what it introduced to us, that confidence in to choose. Have we chose wisely? Has the next generation chosen wisely? Will our children, given the opportunity to choose, are we as a people making the right decisions, or are we squandering this incredible opportunity to choose our own destiny? Everyone have a great night, and again, I hope you enjoy the